Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio has been home to 8 U.S. presidents. They are William Henry Harrison, Ulysses S. Grant, Rutherford B. Hayes, James Garfield, Benjamin Harrison, William McKinley, William Howard Taft, and Warren Harding. Ohio's presidential legacy left a mark on the state and the nation, influencing politics. However, the state is drastically different now than when most of these men served in office. So joining us today from the Ohio History Connection is Megan Wood. She's the Director of Cultural Resources. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you.
And by phone, Associate Professor of Government and Foreign Affairs at Walsh University in North Canton, Ohio, Carl Taylor. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You know, Carl Taylor, back in the day when the first Ohioan, William Henry Harrison, was elected president, things were a lot different. I mean, how has the role of president changed since that time?
Significantly. To a large extent, presidents prior to, let's say, Lincoln, the Civil War in the 1860s, the Congress was much, much more powerful than the executive branch. And, you know, given the presidents over the course of time, a number of them have been able to amass greater power and allowing them to have greater say over foreign and domestic policy, to where today, oftentimes, Congress has become subservient to the president. So significant change in terms of overall power. Most of that occurs largely due to the person who is actually president, not necessarily due to actions by Congress. So significant changes.
And how we run for, I say we as if, but how one would run for president, run a campaign for president, also big changes, right?
Oh, absolutely. The William Henry Harrison was the first president to actively campaign. And, you know, what that means, you know, actively campaigning means he gave speeches from his house. And he did a couple of other things, but by and large, presidents prior to 1840 didn't do anything to actually affect their election. And, you know, all of that changes over the course of time. Obviously, you know, I live in North Canton, Ohio. We have the McKinley Museum here very, very close. And he actively campaigned as well, but he only gave, you know, front porch speeches. And, you know, he ran against a really interesting guy named his name escapes me at this point. His name was William Jennings Bryan. And he did train tours all across the country, which obviously changed the way that people actually campaigned for office as well. So significant changes.
And I would say William Henry Harrison is interesting because he was trying to be the common man versus his opponent, Martin Van Buren. So he talks about drinking hard cider versus drinking champagne.
Kind of like sitting around, I could sit around and drink beer,
right?
You know, kind of a guy.
Yeah, so that's something we have in common, William Henry Harrison and I, hard cider. But, you know, this idea, an early idea, something being the same of being like more of a common man.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the history of presidents from Ohio. There have been 8. 7 were born here. The 8th, I think it was William Henry Harrison, who was born in Virginia.
Yeah, he was a British citizen, actually.
Yeah, and moved here and spent most of his adult life in Ohio. So Ohio claims him, but as does Virginia. A little tiff going on there. You just heard from Megan Wood. She's Director of Cultural Resources at the Ohio History Connection, which has a program. It's called A Presidential Trail. We'll talk about that also with us. Carl Taylor, he's an Associate Professor of Government and Foreign Affairs at Walsh University in Canton. If you have a question or comment about one of those 8 presidents that Ohio claims, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Megan Wood, the presidents, did they come from all over the state? So this presidential trail that you have planned, it's not just central Ohio, it's all over.
Yeah, we have Ohio presidents down in the Cincinnati area, Ulysses S. Grant, sort of close to Cincinnati in like the Georgetown area, Marion with Harding, and then up into Canton and the Cleveland area with McKinley and Garfield. So we have a spread of presidential sites all over the state.
And it didn't have to do with somebody coming from a big city either, right?
No, I think that's one of the remarkable things is looking at where people are from. Harding is a newspaper guy from Marion, places like Canton, Georgetown, that it's sort of normal people in some cases moving up through military service a lot because of the Civil War mm-hmm. and our influence in the Civil War, being able to do extraordinary things.
Carl Tiller, did they have anything in common besides Ohio?
Well, I believe six of the eight were in some way war heroes. Obviously, William Henry Harrison was as well. Oftentimes, political parties would select individuals who had served in war due to the common knowledge that people already had of those individuals. I mean, I think, you know, Ulysses Grant had no political experience prior to becoming president, and obviously that showed once he became president due to, you know, just a litany of different scandals when he actually assumed the position. So you had, obviously, a significant amount of military experience. I believe all of them were either Whigs or Republicans. So that has something to do with it as well. So those are two that immediately come to mind.
Is there anyone that ranks them in terms of, do any of them fall into the great category, Megan Wood?
There's been a lot of rankings over the years by different historians about presidents. I think what's really remarkable is William Howard Taft not only serves as president, but then is appointed by Harding, another Ohioan, to be the 10th Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So the only person to serve in that capacity. You know, and then we have other firsts, like the first congressman elected to president, James Garfield, and he didn't have a lot of time to show what he could have been made of his time in office, and also the first senator and Harding elected as the president.
Right. Garfield was one of two that were assassinated.
That's correct.
Sounds like a lot, but things were different back in the day.
Yeah. And it's a time of more of some political turmoil with the Civil War and opponents to both of those, to both Garfield and McKinley.
The Civil War played a role in Ohio producing lots of commanders in chief, but it also played a role in making a lot of those people pretty wealthy too, right, Carl Taylor?
A lot of them held specific positions. They knew a lot of really important people. A really good example of that would have been William McKinley. He was really, he became a pretty important person in within the ranks of the Republican Party in Ohio. He knew, obviously, a lot of magnates of business. His chief kind of strategist during the 1896 campaign was a guy by the name of Mark Hanna, who also served in the United States Senate from the state of Ohio. And all of them knew business leaders particularly well. And obviously, that would then lead to, you know, the trust busting of Teddy Roosevelt era. But, yeah, their position obviously led to wealth in a lot of different respects. Absolutely.
If we had this many presidents come from Ohio today over the same span of time, people would think there would there was a fix in somewhere. Carl Taylor, what was it about Ohio, or was it different the way people viewed member states anyways at that time?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's several different answers to that. First of all, obviously Ohio becomes a state in 1803. The state of Ohio starts to kind of amass political power. And what I mean by that, in political science, there tends to be a couple of different ways that we can measure political power. And one of those ways is through the number of members of Congress that each state has. For example, in 1840, Ohio has 19 members of Congress. And I believe in 1870, they're still at 19. But however, by 1940, they're at 24. And then obviously today we're at 16. So over the period of time, the amount of political power that Ohio has wielded has obviously increased and then decreased. So that's one way to look at it. So obviously Ohio, in terms of when are the Ohio presidents held the executive office there, had kind of fit in with the period of time in which they had the most political clout in D.C. Another reason that I would point out, too, is the position of Ohio within the states generally. Obviously, Ohio, the eastern Ohio is eastern in nature. Southern Ohio obviously has a lot of southern sentiments, and then obviously western Ohio, northern Ohio's Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a variety of regional impacts. One other impact I would say, too, is pretty quickly after the Republican Party was founded in 1954, Ohio elects one of the first Republican governors in the entire country in 1855, named Salmon Chase, who eventually serves as Treasury Secretary under Lincoln, as well as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, appointed by Lincoln as well. So the Republican Party gets established and becomes pretty prominent really quickly after its establishment. So I would point out, too, that both the Republican and the Democratic Party establishment became pretty entrenched and competitive. Just one example of that. For instance, Rutherford B. Hayes gets elected president, or excuse me, gets elected governor in 1875, but he only wins by 5,000 votes out of 500,000 cast. So he had defeated an incumbent Democratic candidate named William Allen, and that's a pretty interesting fact that half a million votes way back in 1875 were decided by less than 5,000. So something to look at as well.
And I think we look at Ohio and the Civil War is contributing only behind Pennsylvania and New York as far as troops. And then you have the Grand Army of the Republic, which are essentially the alumni group of veterans of the Civil War, which are also politically powerful in the Republican Party and help support all of these former Civil War serving Ohioans becoming president.
I thought, but, of course, the record disputes this, but it would have, that as Ohio gained power politically through organized labor, but that wasn't even really a twinkle in anyone's eye. It was a twinkle in somebody's eye, but it really hadn't taken gotten a firm foothold really by the time Ohio presidents were a thing of the past. Right, Carl Taylor?
Yeah, I didn't I don't know of a significant union impact of, I know Taft and Harding had to put down various strikes when they were president, but union organizing to affect an election, I am not aware of much of an impact
at that point. That's Carl Taylor. He's an associate professor of government and foreign affairs at Walsh University in Canton. Also Megan Wood, she is director of cultural resources at Ohio History Connection, where they've put together a presidential trail in Ohio. There are 8 presidents embraced by the state of Ohio. 7 were born here. 1, William Henry Harrison, was born in Virginia and has spent most of his adult life in Ohio. We're going to talk about that little dispute coming up. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. We're talking about the history of presidents in Ohio. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We are talking about the history of Ohio's 8 presidents, how they made it to the Oval Office, their impact, if any, and why more than 9 decades have elapsed since the last Warren G. Harding was elected in 1920. Still with us is Director of Cultural Resources at the Ohio History Connection, Megan Wood, and by phone, Associate Professor of Government and Foreign Affairs at Walsh University in Canton, Carl Taylor. Carl, can you talk about this dispute with Virginia over who gets William Henry Harrison? What's the deal there?
Well, it's a point of contention generally, just because states are able to kind of advertise that a particular person came from a particular state.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what it is, in my opinion. I mean, obviously Virginia's second in terms of the amount of presence that states have produced, so it mostly has to do with pride and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what do Ohio History Connection have a friendly debate with Virginia, your counterparts in Virginia?
Well, yeah, we like to debate with other states, things like flight and, other
right.
things where Ohio has the brains. And, but, he was born in Virginia and went to school there, but married an Ohio girl, and, you know, really came to this part of the country before Ohio was a state. But I, you know, I think we have a pretty good claim on him with his family and also the time he spent engaged in military action in Ohio, too, places like the Battle of Fallen Timbers.
Right. The famous Battle of Fallen Timbers. Max in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Max.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I just wanted to say on William Henry Harrison, he's definitely an Ohio president. I mean, we don't talk about George H.W. Bush George H.W. Bush being a Massachusetts president. If Kasich was elected, he wouldn't be a Pennsylvania president. William Henry Harrison belongs to Ohio. Come on.
Okay. This is a no-duh thing for you. I got to bring some conflict into this somehow, Max. But yeah, you're right. That's a good point. I mean, is there a standard there? And what do the Virginians say about that, Megan?
I don't think there's a real standard. You know, I'm sure that Indiana also claims Benjamin Harrison because of his time there as well. But he is his tomb is in North Bend, Ohio. It's part of the Presidential Trail.
Uh-huh.
So we're also able to his final resting place is here in Ohio.
OK, Max, thanks for that call. Susan in Nebraska, you're on the air. Hi, Susan.
Hi, I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm calling to kind of put a little defense of Grant, even though he himself had not held elective office as the general of the Army. He dealt with politicians and he dealt with generals, and there was a tremendous amount of politics going on with Halleck when Grant was, working in the Civil War under Halleck. And also the scandals during his presidency were not at all related to him. He himself was very, very honest, which may be one reason that the scandals took hold, because mm-hmm. he himself was so honest. He wasn't ahead of the scandals going on.
He was exploited for that honesty.
Yes, he was extremely honest himself. So anyway, I just want to put a little defense of Grant.
All right.
He is underrated.
Thank you,
okay,
Susan.
Well, thanks. Love your show.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or a comment about the presidents of Ohio. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. When we talk about the location of Ohio, how much of a role did that, you know, you mentioned that it had, you know, it hit on a lot of different regions, Carl Taylor, but it was also kind of the Wild Wild West for a period of time during that time, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to definitely to some degree, it was. And the impact, you know, is just due to people, you know, leaving the East or the South and moving in that particular direction. You know, a lot of the southern counties of Ohio, southern and southeastern, you know, the ones that border the Ohio River, you know, certainly do have significant impacts. And a lot of those were also were the ones that, you know, supported Democratic candidates, while the rest of the state were supporting the Republicans who were Ohio Republicans who would then get elected the president. So that's all I was pointing out. Mm-hmm. It was the wild, wild west in a lot of different respects, especially, you know, when William Henry Harrison was running and, you know, in the, you know, prior to 1840. So absolutely.
And people have the flyover state image of Ohio. But back in the day, most people didn't live in the big cities back then. Am I wrong, Megan Wood? I mean, most of them lived in a place like Ohio.
Right. There's a lot more sort of rural spread of population. And when you look at Ohio, it's the first state carved out of the Northwest Territory. And the Northwest Territory was formed in a completely different way than the eastern states. And the eastern states originally had districts that were running, you know, like the Connecticut Western Reserve was Connecticut land running all the way through Ohio. And, you know, it's really was sort of the second birth of the United States in the Northwest Territory, Ohio being the first state, and then its population growing pretty quickly from, you know, its formation in 1803 until the election of William Henry Harrison and beyond. So you're seeing sort of the next generation of what became the United States of America.
Hmm. John in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hi, I'm just weighing in on this contest between the states for presidential claims again.
Okay.
didn't Benjamin Harrison make most of his career in Indiana? Because are we really allowed to change the rules as we go along? Don't we have to give up one of the Harrisons?
Well, he was born in North Bend, Indiana, at the farm of his grandfather, William Henry Harrison.
In Ohio, yeah.
In Ohio, mm-hmm. yeah. He graduated from Miami University, and he moved to Indianapolis, where he practiced law. Well, what about that, Megan? Is there any dispute?
I think that we could have a friendly sharing of Benjamin Harrison, but I think we'll keep him in our eight.
He was notable for his support of the Sherman Antitrust Act. It was sponsored by John Sherman of Mansfield, Ohio. Again, I think you make the salient point, Carl Taylor, that there were a lot of other lawmakers. There were a lot of other people from Ohio at that time. They kind of buttressed their work in Washington.
Absolutely. Sherman, John Sherman was one of those really important Republicans, especially, and he was in Congress for an extended period of time. I believe he was there during the Civil War, if memory serves. So absolutely, Sherman and just a variety of others. And that's one of the reasons, too, that I would point out, too, that why political parties, especially the Republicans, would look towards a state like Ohio for potential, you know, presidential nominees because of, you know, electoral history and regional issues, you know, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, he was John Sherman was elected to Congress in 1853.
Okay.
So, yeah. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. We're talking about the presidents of Ohio today. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. How do you use the historical sites in this presidential trail, as you call it, Megan Wood? How does it work?
So you can find it through Tourism Ohio or through the Ohio History Connection, trails.ohio.org. And there are 13 stops that allow you to see the full breadth of Ohio presidents and the places that we have left to remember them. So some of them being home, some of them birthplaces, some of them libraries, and some of them also final resting places. So you can download it on your phone. It'll allow you to go right into your map app, and you can see all the locations, mm-hmm. and you can also see pictures when they're open, and you can sort of check off for yourself when you've visited all 13 sites.
Who rivals Ohio when it comes to the number of presidents? I know there's another state that claims eight.
Yeah, Virginia is up there. Texas has quite a few presidents mm-hmm. as well, but I don't think that any can really rival sort of the concentration, too, in time, you mm-hmm. know, during that Civil War period.
There is Carl Taylor, who would you say was the most influential president from among the group?
Gosh, that's a great question. Most influential. Well, I guess I'd have to get rid of William Henry Harrison.
Because a month, you just can't get a lot done in a month, right?
Yeah, and obviously James Garfield, he wasn't around for very long. I would pinpoint a couple. Rutherford B. Hayes, due to, you know, kind of hit by the way, you know, the 1876 presidential election, you know, if there's any election to read about, it's probably that one, due to its corruption, its complexity, the candidates, and a variety of things. So I would pinpoint him because basically that was the end of Reconstruction, the reorganization of the Southern states, the kind of the rebirth of the Southern Democratic Party, you know, the kind of the establishment of, you know, the kind of the establishment of segregation laws in the South. And mm-hmm. by the way, I mean, Hayes doesn't support that. What I'm saying is his election kind of forwards that and allows that to occur. And then, you know, a couple of others, you know, obviously McKinley is president during a particularly important period in American history during the expansionism, you know, towards Puerto Rico and Guam and the Philippines. He upheld the gold standard. You know, he was obviously president during a time of you know, a business upheaval with monopolies and that sort of thing. And then I would also point out Taft, too, due in large part to his efforts against antitrust and that sort of thing. So I would pinpoint those three.
You know, I think of William McKinley and the fact that he was assassinated by the anarchist and in 1901, and the fact that his vice president was Theodore Roosevelt, and I wonder what impact that had on Roosevelt's career, being catapulted into the Oval Office in that way.
Yeah, really, really interesting. That selection. If memory serves as well, Teddy Roosevelt was the governor of New York. He was pretty, he's pretty outspoken. He was kind of selected for the vice presidency, due in part to kind of keep him quiet. And obviously, that kind of backfired once McKinley was assassinated. I know the elders in the Republican Party, in 1900, especially Mark Hanna, really disliked him. So obviously there wasn't much celebrating once McKinley was assassinated in a lot of different circles. So.
Right. But it did change a trajectory there. Maybe unintended consequences, who knows?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Rutherford B. Hayes, born in Delaware, Ohio, fought in the Civil War again. He was a lawyer in Cincinnati. Is it typical that they were lawyers? We've mentioned the Civil War and being Civil War heroes or having fought in the Civil War. But Megan Wood, was there another trend there with lawyers?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think it's pretty common. Obviously, William Howard Taft also in the law, being a judge before he was president and then being a Supreme Court justice. But you have Harding, who runs a newspaper. Yep. And was running against another Ohio newspaper man in James Cox, which it's really interesting to think about two gentlemen in the news business running for president,
yeah.
Both being from the same state. At one point, William Henry Harrison was on a path of potentially becoming a doctor and veered off of that because he disliked it. So I think we have a little bit of we have a little more mix amongst the Ohio presidents.
People in the news business, publishers and that kind of thing, that wasn't that unusual back in the day. Was it, Carl Taylor?
It was not. There were a number of really noted individuals in the news business who ran for president. I think most notably was probably Horace Greeley, who lost in 1872 to Grant when he was elected to a second term. Horace Greeley, he was in charge of several different newspapers in New York City for a period of time. So, yeah, newspaper individuals, oftentimes did run for office and were successful.
Did it ever become a campaign tactic to say, don't elect another person from Ohio? Carl?
That's a great question.
Well, because we don't want people from the coast, the coastal elites and that kind of a thing. And I wonder if there was a point where people were saying, seriously? I mean, because it really was a big run for a period of years.
Yeah, listen, that's a great question. I'm not entirely familiar with a lot of the different, tactics that were used in terms of the vocabulary and that sort of thing. So that's a great question. It's absolutely possible, but I'm unfamiliar with any point.
Did you ever hear of anything, Megan Wood?
No, we recently had an exhibit where we were talking about some of the election language, and there you do see some things like who's a common man and who's out with the people. Not as much about avoiding Ohio and that kind of sentiment. Interesting to look at, maybe slightly more issue-based campaign ideas that they were talking about. And you think about how they're getting their message out. There's a little more nuance, more characters in the campaign language when you're not focusing on, media like we do now.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine, in the day that William Henry Harrison was the first to campaign outwardly. But he was also, it was interesting that on the inauguration day, he also gave the longest inauguration speech up to that point. But then he wandered around shaking people's hands for a couple of days, and that made him sick, right?
Yeah, he is not subject to having the short attention span of having a televised speech. But also the way that you campaign and the way that you're talking to people, it's a little more face-to-face when you've been the first president to have a campaign.
Mm-hmm. And he wandered around the Washington shaking hands in very bitter cold.
It's supposedly without his coat on as well. And, he was only in office for 31 days. And his wife, Anna, never even made it to join him at the White House in D.C., so she never took up residence in the White House.
By the way, any notable first ladies from Ohio?
Well, I like to talk about Florence Harding being the first lady to vote. So the women's suffrage, the 19th Amendment is ratified in August of 20. And so come the 20 election, Florence Harding is able to vote, actually vote for her husband, we assume.
Yeah. Carl Taylor.
Yeah, I would pinpoint Julia Grant. She was, you know, obviously first lady from 1869 all the way up until 1877. And she was particularly forward in her belief in support of women's rights. I would pinpoint that one. Which is interesting considering her her background growing up in the South. So I would pinpoint her.
And if one of the sites on our trail, the Rutherford B. Hayes Presidential Library Museums, Rutherford B. Hayes' wife, Lucy Webb Hayes, what you see in the museum there is the relationship between the two of them. I love that in the exhibits there's really this great use of their letters and their diary entries, and how you see a really strong relationship between the two of them. Because I think all of us know that nobody in a position like this is alone without their relationships of advisors and their wives. So.
Right. We are going to take another break. We are talking about the history of presidents from Ohio. You just heard Megan Wood. She's Director of Cultural Resources at the Ohio History Connection. And we'll have a link to their Ohio Presidential Trail. It's a special link that shows you where the presidents are, where they're buried, where they were born, that kind of a thing. If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Also with us, Carl Taylor. He's Associate Professor of Government and Foreign Affairs at Walsh University in Canton. And joining us will be Paul Beck, political scientist at Ohio State. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio was once known as the cradle of presidents for producing eight U.S. presidents beginning in 1840 with the election of William Henry Harrison and ending with the 1920 election of Warren Harding. We're talking about those eight men, how just one state produced so many presidents, and why the dearth of winning candidates going forward. Still with us is Director of Cultural Resources for the Ohio History Connection, Megan Wood. Also by phone, Associate Professor of Government and Foreign Affairs at Walsh University in Canton, Carl Taylor. And joining us is Ohio State University political scientist, Paul Beck. Welcome back, Paul.
Good to be with you, Ann. Thank you.
You know, a lot of people in the wake of the last presidential election have complained and want us to revisit the issue of the Electoral College. Rutherford B. Hayes won the presidency by a margin of one electoral vote back then. And I was wondering, was it disputed as much back then as it has been this time around?
Oh, heavily disputed in that 1876 election. It was there was a lot of corruption that went on there. There were stolen votes in some of the southern states. Ned Foley in our law school has written really well about that particular contest. And of course, it was what, you know, the deal basically was to remove Northern troops from the South at the end of Reconstruction.
Why was that a deal regarding the presidential election?
Well, that got the Southern votes that Hayes needed to be able to be a winner in the Electoral College. And of course, the South was determined to get the occupation, as they would have thought of them, the occupation troops out of the South. And so that was the deal that was cut by the party, by the way, the Republicans, who, of course, had waged the Civil War in many respects and had been the party of Reconstruction in the South.
And you said that when we were getting started that there was a lot of shenanigans in that election process.
Oh, yes. A lot of challenged votes, particularly in a couple of southern states, if I remember right, maybe in the north as well. These were typically not particularly clean elections.
And or they could have been dirty elections.
They could have been dirty. I mean, they were, you know, highly competitive. Mm-hmm. And they also were, you know, this was a period of political machines in both the South and the North. The Northern machines, by the way, were mostly Republican. And so there were a lot of manufactured votes in these elections.
You know, Carl Taylor, what was voter participation back in the day?
Much higher than it was today. The 1876 upwards of looks like I believe it was upwards of 75%, 80% when, you know, the election a couple years ago at this point was 60%, 61%, something like that. So
yeah.
Participation was much, much greater.
And, of course, women weren't permitted the vote at that point.
Yeah, there were far fewer people who had the right to vote at that point as well.
Absolutely.
We have a special guest on line one, Paolo Di Maria, our superintendent of public instruction in the state of Ohio. Hi, Paolo.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Good, thanks. What's up?
Always love a great conversation about Ohio's president. And I wanted to just emphasize, you know, again, I love the question about, you know, who among them distinguished themselves. And I'm a big Rutherford B. Hayes fan, partially because I think he had such a great track record of public service, starting, you know, in Cincinnati when he was Cincinnati city solicitor. And then he served three terms as governor. And then there was a term in Congress somewhere in there, and mm-hmm. then his presidential service. And then after that, you know, he was instrumental in the founding of Ohio State University, served on their board of trustees. So, you know, really kind of front-to-back track record of great service to the state.
He did not run for a second term, though. What do we know about that, Carl or Paul or Paolo? Why he didn't run for a second term?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
My understanding was that it was a part of that agreement that if he was elected in 1876, that he would not run for a second term.
Ah, okay. Well, Paolo Di Maria, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for listening.
All the time, Ann.
Thanks.
Great work.
I would add here that this was a period where the presidents were not even close to important as they are today.
Mm-hmm.
The Absolutely. Federal government didn't have much money. The states were where the action was in many cases. And so it wasn't a prize that people wanted to hang on to. Or to vie for that matter.
Hmm. You know, James Garfield, he was the 20th president of the United States. He was born in Orange in Cuyahoga County. I don't even know if that place still exists anymore. He was the last president to be born in a log cabin. And I'm wondering if you guys can talk about the significance of that and how was that a selling point back in the day? Because it sure would be today. I mean, except now we have a president in office who used being fabulously wealthy and living in penthouse apartments. But conversely, when did the log cabin go out of style?
Well, we need to remember that it wasn't until the early 1900s that the country became majority urban. So this was still a rural country during much of the run of these Ohio
right.
presidents. And, of course, in those days, growing up in a small town was one thing. But growing up in a log cabin, you know, really allowed you to be identified.
It was Lincoln-esque.
As a man of the people,
yeah.
in effect.
The James A. Garfield birthplace, which is in Moreland Hills, there's the Moreland Hills Historical Society runs. It's actually a rebuild of what they think the cabin looked like. So there's also this idea and memory when we rebuild or we save places, especially for an assassinated president, that, you know, that there's something important. We still think there's something, you know, important about this idea of a log cabin.
And he was the last one. Had most of the ones before him been born in log cabins? I mean, was that pretty typical, Carl Taylor?
Absolutely. I mean, if the family wasn't wealthy, you're talking about a log cabin. If they were wealthy, you're talking about a larger plantation like some of the early Virginians came from.
Yeah. William McKinley assassinated by an anarchist in 1901. What was the impact of that happening on our sense about the presidency? Paul Beck?
Well, it's interesting in terms of the politics of it. The Teddy Roosevelt, of course, was the vice president under McKinley, and he was put in that position mainly because Republicans wanted to get him out of New York, where he was doing great damage to the things they cared about as governor.
Yeah.
And so he was an accidental president and, of course, emerged as one of our great presidents. McKinley presided over the presidency at an important time for this country. The Spanish-American War was fought during that period of time, and it also was a period where the Republican Party really emerges as the dominant party in this country, whereas it was much more competitive after the Civil War, particularly once the Southern states joined. And it went back and forth between Democrats and Republicans. But after 1896, the Republicans, except for the Woodrow Wilson interlude, when the party was split between Roosevelt and Taft, the Republican Party really dominated American politics all the way up until the Depression of 1929.
And Roosevelt, I think, was supportive of Taft at first and then tries
to— They were
to,
great friends.
Yeah, and then he, you know, picks him as sort of his successor and then really splits the vote in that his second election. So, you know, his influence continues, you know, well into the early 20th century.
And Roosevelt ran against—
Yes,
Taft,
the 1912 election was a three-candidate election, and Roosevelt really denied Taft continuation as president. Wilson wins with a minority of votes, but a plurality. He came in first, and came in first certainly in the Electoral College.
Yeah, Roosevelt and Taft are splitting the Republican vote.
We know, Carl Taylor, that the Taft family, you know, a dynasty was started there, and it continues until pretty recent history. But you don't get the sense that other former presidents that came from Ohio had the same dynastic impact as, say, a William Howard Taft. Why do you think?
That's a great question. I mean, in terms of Ohio, if you look at dynasty families, I mean, every state in the Union has pretty much some form of, you know, political family dynasty, if you will. But really, Ohio, the one to look to is the Taft family, you know, with obviously William Howard Taft and then Robert Taft first and then the second. So beyond that, I mean, why did future family members of the other presidents not eventually serve? That's a great question.
Well, of course, you know, Benjamin Harrison, the grandson of William Henry Harrison, ended up, but he spent a lot of his life in Indiana, as we mentioned earlier. What do you think, Paul?
Well, it may be that Ohio, after Taft and certainly after Harding in 1920, sort of passes away as a really important incubator of not only presidents but presidential candidates.
What happened?
I think of Taft in the 1950s, Mr. Republican,
right,
in a sense, but he's defeated mainly by Wall Street Republicans. Ohio is less important in terms of its size. Other states begin to have more electoral votes than Ohio, and probably less important in the calculations of politicians who want a winner running for president. The great advantage of Ohio was – I'm sorry, Carl. Be quick. The great advantage of Ohio was that people who had been successful in Ohio politics often were able to get both Democratic and Republican votes. And that meant that the Midwest particularly that had those kinds of areas, you know, southern Ohio being Democratic, the rest of Ohio being more or less Republican, was seen as an important swing state in many ways for the presidency. And that advantaged Ohio. But as our Electoral College numbers have gone down relative to other states, Ohio simply has been less important.
Hmm. Yeah, Carl Taylor?
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with with Mr. Beck on a couple of different points. The first being, you know, obviously Robert Taft was defeated three separate times, I believe, for the presidency. Most notably in 1948, I believe he finished second in, you know, during the convention to Dewey, who was obviously, you know, the former governor of New York there at the time. The other thing was 1940 is really the point in time where Ohio really does start to lose electoral votes. So absolutely, I agree with that 100%.
And, you know, going forward, were they as party specific? I mean, the individuals, I suppose once you get to, you know, later on in the process, when we've got, you know, well, I mean, I'm just wondering how important were the parties to the voters writ large?
I think party was very important. You know, this
more than now. There weren't really the
independent. It's very important now. I think it's come back in a way, even though parties seem to be despised by many voters. But partisans, you know, Democrats and Republicans vote for the candidates of their party in great fidelity to their partisan views.
Hmm. And when we look at Civil War and post-Civil War in the like newspapers, you'll have towns that have a Republican and a Democratic paper. It was pretty clear,
right,
you know, what media you're consuming and what your party affiliation is.
Yeah. And all except for one of the presidents from Ohio are Republicans.
Yes. William Henry Harrison was a Whig before the Republican right. Party was founded. The other thing to point out is that when the officers were coming back from the Civil War, they basically established the guts of the Republican Party operations in many of these states, certainly Ohio. And if you look at the Ohio presidents who had served in the Civil War, they had Civil War experience. And so it's almost as if the Grand Army of the Republic comes back from the war and then settles in as the top level of the Republican Party in the Midwest and other parts of the country as well.
Do any of you see any kind of trend like this going forward, or is the United States too big, too populous, too many mouths to feed kind of a place to ever have that many coming from one place again? Carl Taylor?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, if we're looking at just generally political clout or, you know, the availability of electoral resources, you know, to run a campaign on, obviously, you know, we've had a number of presidents from California, Nixon, Reagan. You've got a number of presidents from New York, from Texas. So, it could certainly happen again. I think it could at least.
Mm. Yeah. Paul Beck?
I think it's less likely to happen. The run of Ohio presidents came in a very unique time because of the way Ohio was politically. It was advantageous to the Republicans to nominate somebody from Ohio. And, of course, we had a lot of electoral votes. We at one point were, for quite a while, we were third in terms of the number of electoral college electors. We are now seventh, but a very distant seventh and going down. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to lose another seat when it comes to the 2021 redistricting. So I think Ohio is less advantaged. It doesn't mean there won't be candidates from Ohio, mm-hmm. and maybe even a nominee from Ohio, but there's not going to be a run of such candidates.
Mm. And I think maybe with the way we look at identity and how people move around, when Ohio was the mother of presidents, you're not moving around from state to state, the same amount of mobility and how we may identify with a candidate may not just be based on where they're from, but a lot of other identifiers.
There was just people that grew up with these guys in public office, and they were very familiar to them. Hmm. Interesting. Carl Taylor, I want to say thanks to you for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Carl Taylor is an associate professor of government and foreign affairs at Walsh University in Canton. And also Megan Wood, a director of cultural resources at the Ohio History Connection. Thanks for your help today as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You can learn more about the Ohio History Connection's presidential, what do you call it?
Presidential trail,
right. We'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And Paul Beck, political scientist at Ohio State, thanks for joining us as always.
Thank you, Ann. Good to be here.
That's it today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. She yelled in